Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV
Good
One.
Good morning, I'm Roland Martin. Next on News One Now, Black women standing up for Jemele Hill. We'll talk about the Black Women's Roundtable and Black Women for Positive Change, releasing an open letter to ESP and calling for them to reinstate Jemele Hill immediately. We'll talk with Melanie Campbell, President and CEO of the Black Women's Roundtable. Saying enough is enough, Texas Democratic Congressman Al Green unveils articles of impeachment against Donald Trump. We will play what he had to say on the floor of the U.S. House. Also, last night on Sean Hannity, Trump said Chicago is not America. Really? Really? It's not America. Okay. Would that play you the video of what he had to say when discussing violence in Chicago? Also, Kasim Reed, mayor of Atlanta, he has endorsed Keisha Lance Bottoms, who is running to replace him for mayor in a crowded 12-person race. We will show you that as well. Also on the show, former NBA star Jason Williams was at the top of his profession, the promising broadcast career after his playing days, but alcohol derailed his rise, leading to the death of a man. We will talk about that and also how he is trying to help others with his substance abuse center in Miami. Bishop T.D. Jakes will be soaring with us. He'll be discussing his new book, Soar, right here, News One Now on TV One. Plus, we'll talk about the issue of race and legacy in admissions. I caused a little kerfuffle a few years ago with President George W. Bush. We'll chat with Tim Wise about the issue of legacy and admissions. And Jay-Z is saying, well, Harvey Weinstein, I'm done, player. I got to go. Plus, we'll talk with the author of a book on Thurgood Marshall. Of course, the movie airs this weekend. Plus, what the hell? We got a packed two-hour show. It's time to bring the funk. News One Now on TV One. Let's roll. It is time to reinstate Jemele Hill. That is the substance of a letter sent to ESPN by a group of Black women who are standing with Jemele Hill. Here is that letter. It was sent by the Black Women's Roundtable. We are writing in Jemele's Hill on Jemele's behalf regarding the current controversy about her tweets about President Trump and Jerry Jones and her recent two-week suspension from ESPN. Initially, we were prepared to send ESPN a letter of support for accepting Jemele Hill's apology, since we thought you understood Jemele was expressing her personal views over a private medium, much the way President Trump does when he tweets about national and international leaders. We thought ESPN was in support of the right of news commentators to have the opportunity to express their personal opinions under the provisions of the First Amendment in the Constitution of the United States. The letter also says, we encourage ESPN to reverse course immediately from suspension to support of Jemele, so that we might be inclined not to withdraw our support of ESPN and its sponsors by encouraging our national networks of viewers to do likewise. Jemele Hill is an outstanding sports reporter who has been with ESPN since 2006, and millions of viewers appreciate her professional sports coverage and regularly tune in to watch her reporting and to support ESPN advertisers. We encourage ESPN to stand your ground in supporting Jemele, and we will stand our ground to support ESPN. Joining us right now is Melanie Campbell, President and CEO of the Black Women's Roundtable. Melanie, first of all, how many other groups also signed this letter?
At least 30, and this is an open letter that we're going to release today, and others will sign on. But with all that's been happening with Jemele, what's happening with Jerry Jones, with the Dallas Cowboys, and the president's constant tweets, and then even the NFL yesterday, there seems to be some kind of, in my personal opinion, some kind of conspiracy to really shut down the ability for Black people to stand up for issues that are important to us. And so when was it that a sports commentator couldn't make a comment about an issue that was being discussed in the course of sports? Mm-hmm. And so she had a right to state what she said. She didn't call for a boycott, but she does have a right freedom of speech with my good friend here, Scott Bolden, a lawyer, correct me, have a right to have a freedom of speech.
And so in the letter you said that it was over a private medium. Well, Twitter isn't private. It's a it's public medium and it's a publicly traded company.
Right.
And so they said it was in violation of their social media policy, which they in their letter said it was that happened the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a repeat.
Well, the reality is she had a right the first time to speak up. And the question comes, it's the distraction of what it is, the issue is about racial injustice in this country. And so the conversation about the flag or whether or not she should be able to say, all of that is a distraction from the issue. And it's incumbent upon all of us who profess ourselves to be leaders, whether you are in locally or to the national level, to speak up when we see injustice, because when they go after her, they're coming for you. You or me next. And so we have to stand up now, or this thing is a slippery slope. And so in the last 48 hours, we came together. Black Women for Positive Change reached out to me and asked me if we would partner with them with the Black Women's Roundtable, and I reached out to as many people I could get to know that we needed to speak up expeditiously. And so this letter is an attempt at that, and then there'll be others, I'm sure, who will sign on as well.
We had, of
and it's
course,
black women and black men. We have several brothers who signed on too.
The other day, Reverend Al Sharpton held a news conference
outside of
ESPN, saying that civil rights leaders are calling for a meeting with ESPN. Has there been any response to that from ESPN, to your knowledge?
Not to my knowledge, but I haven't talked to him.
Let's introduce our panel: A. Scott Bolden, legal analyst and chairman of the National Bar Association PAC; Pastor Shannon Wright, third vice chair of the Maryland GOP; Robert Petillo, attorney and host of CBS Radio Atlanta. So ESPN says she violated their social media policy with comments on Twitter. She did not call for a boycott.
Mm-hmm.
Someone tweeted her, and then so she simply responded as saying, well, you want to hold the players accountable. What about the advertisers of the Dallas Cowboys? ESPN, within their rights to suspend her for these comments after they said this was the second infraction?
Absolutely. You and I got into this a few weeks ago about whether you could be fired or suspended for violating for a company or for expressing, rather, your First Amendment. And I said to you then, and I'll say to you now, that you cannot be suspended or fired for exercising your First Amendment. However, your contract, her contract, says otherwise. And if she violates that, and she chose to violate that not once but twice, then they can suspend her. It's their discretion, if you will. I agree with everything Melanie says. I agree with the letter and what have you, because Trump's narrative has caused this confusion or this murkiness, because we're all making political statements now because of his negative narrative and his presidency. That being said, though, she contracted that right away. ESPN is within their right to do it. They held off the first time. The second time, this was really purposeful and intentional, and it may be her stand, if you will. But at the same time, the real issue is, does she come back in 2 weeks? Does she file a lawsuit? Or does she go on because of this political statement that she wants to take on a political agenda as opposed to a sports agenda?
Robert, you're an attorney. Your legal assessment.
Well, under contract law, the ESPN absolutely has the right to suspend her for violation of her contract. However, there's a difference between a legal right and doing the right thing. I think that all people of good conscience should boycott ESPN until such time as they allow their anchors to have equal free speech rights. Donald Trump should not be allowed to bully people, to bully networks, to bully people out of their free speech, out of their ability to articulate their own views and their own opinions. Right now, Jemele Hill's held to a higher standard than the President of the United States of America. She can be suspended, censured, fired for her exercise on Twitter. Donald Trump can start World War III with a tweet, and nobody can say anything about it.
Shannon, what is interesting here is that when you look at what she tweeted,
mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to understand, folks. We have the tweet. Can you pull it up, please? I'm just trying to understand exactly what did they find offensive. Because in the tweet, she did not call for a boycott. This is what she tweeted. This play always works. Change happens when advertisers are impacted. If you feel strongly about JJ's statement, boycott his advertisers. Now, let's keep in mind, the ESPN is in bed with the NFL. They are a partner of the NFL. So, by suggesting boycott his advertisers, his advertisers are ESPN's advertisers because they are in partnership with the league.
Right. What she said was true. I mean, if you do certain things, you will affect folks' pocketbook and they will pay attention. So personally, I think there are a lot more offensive things being said all around on all sides of the aisle and everywhere else than that. I don't find offense with it. I think the only issue is, does it violate a contract that she signed?
But the question then is, what does it actually violate? I mean, what, because is it you can't, so, I mean, again, all the personalities tweet a lot of stuff. True. I'm just trying to understand, what does it actually violate?
I don't think what she said was offensive or incorrect in that she said it. Having not seen her contract, I can't say what it violated. I know it's being said that what she did violated her contract. However, if you are in a position to have a voice, in my thought, you are obligated then to voice what you feel is correct and to use that voice in that platform.
And remember, other folks have been suspended. Right. Stephen A. Smith was suspended for some comments. Bill Simmons, who was white, was suspended for some comments. So it's not like Kurt Schilling was suspended and was later fired. So they've had other folks.
In the context of all the things that are happening, this is where we have a concern. What's happening with Jemele Hill? What's happening with Colin Kaepernick? What Jerry Jones said the other day? All of these, Roger Goodell said yesterday, right? All of these things are connected. And so we have to speak up and challenge what's happening, because this is really about shutting down the ability to deal with the issue of racial injustice in this country and the killing of black and brown people in this country. And so that no one's talking about that. It's all about the NFL and the flag and the this and that. I was in Florida just the other day. Look, in Florida, what's going on? The KKK just came out with flyers in Jacksonville and Orlando, telling folks if a black man looks at a white woman, you know, they're going to get killed. There's a lot of hatred and visceral things going on in this country, and it is connected. And so we have to stand up. Jemele Hill is an example of that. There's legal things, but the bottom line is it's all connected, and we need to stand up.
Well, it certainly is. But what's different about this is that the white supremacy and white privilege is manifesting itself outwardly, publicly, that it's become a comfortable space for those who believe or who would tolerate that. With Jemele Hill, you're right, this narrative is being caught up in these other things, but I gotta tell you, the provision of her contract that says you cannot make political statements on a public medium that would affect this network. Remember, she's a journalist, right? Mm-hmm. She's suggesting, more than suggesting in her tweet, that somehow a team that she covers as an independent journalist, if you will, that perhaps they should be boycotted
Let me correct you. First of all, journalist is an umbrella term. She is a journalist, but she is paid to have a subjective point of view. So she is not like reporters they have there who cover the teams who do not have the leeway to give opinion. She is paid to give her opinion.
Okay, Twitter.
That violates her contract. No, it doesn't. No, hold on. Let me correct you again, Scott. You can be the attorney all day, but they have multiple individuals, and we can pull them up. Mm-hmm. Mike Wilbon, Stephen A. Smith, Bamani Jones, Jemele Hill. I can go down. Michael Smith.
They're paid for their opinion.
No. They also are allowed to give their perspectives on social media, and in fact, ESPN integrates this, and this is sports related.
Okay.
This is sports.
This is
sports related.
Pull
the tweet up again.
It's related.
This is what
the money and the
this
bottom
is what
line.
She said. This
and their
is
partnership.
This
you
is
won't
sports.
Get a reaction. I'm
this
sorry.
This is sports.
That's
no. I know they're going to get a reaction, but my point is, let's not act like she can't give her opinion when she's paid to give her opinion. Robert, go ahead.
This is part and parcel of what happens to African Americans in this country. Jemele Hill and Michael Smith were put on the 6 o'clock Sports Center in order to spice it up, to bring more attention, to talk not just about sports, but pop culture, entertainment, politics, to bring breathe life back into that part of the Sports Center franchise. And then as soon as they do that, as soon as they do exactly exactly what they paid them to do. If it crosses that line into upsetting or making white people uncomfortable, then you have to immediately punish them. It's just like we put Elvis as the face of rock and roll instead of Bo Diddley, because they don't want that much blackness in there. They just want enough to spice it up, but not enough to upset the apple cart.
Well, Melody, go ahead.
Bottom line, I love you, my classmate. Right? I think you're wrong. I'm gonna go get my law degree, right, just to prove you wrong. But the bottom line is, we have to stand up.
Already.
We have
to stand up. We ain't gonna go get a law degree to prove Scott wrong. That's easy. It's the brother sitting at home proving Scott wrong.
But the bottom line is, if we don't speak up now, and really for her, for Colin, and all, Kaepernick, and everybody else, then we're not doing our job.
I agree. Certainly, let us know if ESPN responds. Thanks a bunch, folks. We come back. Congressman Al Green blasted Donald Trump and read articles of impeachment on the House floor. We'll discuss that. Plus, wait till I play for y'all what Trump said last night to that idiot Sean Hannity when they talked about crime in Chicago. Two of the dumbest people talking to each other. You know what that produces? A dumb conversation. I will play it for you. Also this hour, we'll chat with Bishop T.D. Jakes about his new book, Soar. All of that right here, News 1 Now on TV One.
Okay, government might have shut down.
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News 1 Now with Roland Martin.
I rise today on behalf of the many who have concluded that enough is enough.
Houston Congressman Al Green on the floor of the House yesterday unveiling articles of impeachment against Donald Trump. Green says Trump is fueling an alt-right hate machine. Green cited Trump's record of racism and sexism in his verbal attacks on NFL players and their mothers. He also says Trump is associating his office with bigotry by refusing to denounce hate groups. And the congressman also cites Trump's false claims that millions of people voted illegally in the 2016 presidential election.
Donald John Trump, unmindful of the high duties of his high office and the dignity and proprieties thereof, and of the harmony and respect and courtesies which ought to exist and be maintained within American society, has undermined the integrity of his office, has brought disrepute on the presidency, has betrayed his trust as president to the manifest injury of the people of the United States of America, and as a result is unfit to be president. Therefore, Donald John Trump, by betraying his trust as president, warrants impeachment, trial, and removal from office, and disqualification to hold any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States of America.
All over time.
Green introduced the articles with the expectation of giving House members at least 2 days to consider them. But the GOP moved to consider the resolution less than an hour after Green left the floor, effectively killing a vote on the impeachment articles for now. In the past, senior Democrats have said it's premature to consider impeachment. As for Congressman Green, he says he plans to reintroduce the bill sometime in the future. All right. Y'all thoughts about this? Is it too early?
This is silly and idiotic. And this is the exact reason people don't take us politically significant. While Chuck and Nancy are at the White House working on a deal on DACA to protect the Dreamers, we're on the floor introducing bills that we can't pass. Al Green doesn't have the votes to pass a peach pie, let alone impeachment. There's no way it'll get to the House Judiciary Committee. There's no way there'll be a House vote. There's not a two-thirds majority in the Senate for removal. John Roberts is going to preside over the case as the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So what exactly is he hoping to do with this? When you have African Americans around the country standing up for criminal justice reform, you're talking about, I kneel with Kaepernick, I'm boycotting, I'm taking a knee, introduce a bill that will address those issues.
Robert, I could take exactly what you just said. I could literally take your exact arguments and take that everything you said and apply the criminal justice reform and repeat it right back to you. I'm not done. African Americans have introduced bills to deal with criminal justice reform. You said that there will not be a Judiciary Committee hearing on this. Bob Goodlatte, who is the chair of that particular committee, will not hold a single hearing on the very bills Black members of Congress have introduced on the issue. Second, you said the House will not vote on this. The House Republican caucus will not allow the bill to even be considered unless they have at least 218 votes in their House caucus. You keep making the argument that the Black caucus members should do something on criminal justice reform. They have done exactly what you have said, and the Republicans have thwarted them at every turn. Now what do you propose they should do?
Well, you do exactly what Chuck and Nancy are doing. You go to the White House with the first piece of legislation.
Hold on.
One of the first things that Donald Trump did was sign a Blue Lives Matter bill when he got into office to sign an executive order on that. So Chuck and Nancy can negotiate on DACA, can negotiate on Dreamers, can negotiate on wall funding. Why can't we be there to negotiate on behalf of people in our community?
What happened when this Congressional Black Caucus presented Donald Trump a 130-page document about what Black folks have to lose and included criminal justice reform? What did he do with it?
Well, what was our negotiating chip on that?
Robert, if you don't even read the document, you ain't gonna be negotiating. And show me where, please, take your time. I can give you my iPad for Shelly to pull up. Show me where Donald Trump has made a definitive statement speaking about the issue of criminal justice reform that victims might appreciate. All we've heard has been law and order, I love cops.
Well, if you're going to say that, then you have to realize what exactly the Democrats are negotiating on right now. The first thing he did was attack immigrants when he got into office. So why are Chuck and Nancy negotiating with right now?
Did you not just see 48 hours ago when he pulled back, when he's going to cancel the deal? All right, hold it.
Because it's part of the negotiation process.
No, it's not.
What Trump does is negotiate to the mean.
He doesn't negotiate.
He takes the extreme position, then you negotiate back to where you started.
Okay, let's see if he negotiates this. Last night, he was on Sean Hannity, which was nothing but beach ball television. Okay, no real discussions there. And so here is Sean, who really cares about Black people, love discussing Chicago, ain't never taking his show to Chicago. Listen to these two buffoons on this issue. Shelly, go to my iPad.
When you look at the Obama years, Chicago, one city, his adopted hometown, 3,900 people were murdered. In the last 6 years of Obama's presidency, 18,000 shootings. I don't think he mentioned it but three or four times.
Yeah, it's hard to believe.
And disproportionately, his economic policies hurt Black Americans, Hispanic Americans more.
That's very sad.
How will your policies help minorities that are still struggling?
Well, first of all, minorities want police protection more than anybody. They need it more than anybody. It's what's going on is crazy. And you look at some of these inner cities where it's just out of control. And remember, I was saying things like, we will, you know, what do you have to lose? We will fix it. We're going to fix it. But one of the things we're doing very strongly now is the inner cities. Now, Chicago is out of control. I don't know what they're doing in Chicago to have this many shootings and this many killings and all of the different things that are going on.
Really? I don't know what they're doing. How about you be the president and go? You know, where's your plan?
You know, here's the thing.
I love to hear it.
Right, but you're not. The silence is deafening. What do we have to lose? The better question is, what do we have to gain under Donald Trump? But in the first 9 months of his presidency, we've heard nothing about his urban agenda. We've heard nothing about the resources he's sending, jobs, job training, education, money, resources, you name it.
So there's nothing to negotiate.
There's nothing to negotiate because it's not a priority. He's too busy creating these culture wars, but while you've got the killing fields of Chicago going on, if Obama failed Chicago, then he's certainly doing no better than that because he hasn't put any attention to it either.
Shannon, that particular clip from Axios, they clipped it, didn't have it. Leah Ruggiero sent me another clip where he went, this is not the United States of America. Actually, dude, it is. It is. I mean, at the end of the day, this is very simple. Trump has absolutely no plan of action that involves Black people. Have you seen it?
You haven't said anything I disagreed with, actually.
No, I'm just asking, have you seen it? Because I know I haven't seen it.
Well, I have seen things.
Or poor people, for that matter.
I have seen things that would lead one on paper to believe there is a plan. But I, quite honestly, haven't seen that much of a plan for Black folk from too many electeds across the board. You know, we are not a priority. Our dollars don't control what happens in other folks' pockets. We don't use the dollars that we do spend in a way to effectively get folks to understand we're serious about the things that we say. So no, we're not a priority. We don't do things in a manner that would say to folks, we intend for you to look at us as a priority. We don't.
Bottom line is this here. What you have with Green reading the impeachment articles on the floor. Look, you've had Republicans. Republicans voted 50 plus times on the Affordable Care Act, knowing full well the Senate was not going to move on it and Obama wasn't going to sign it. Robert, they still did it.
And they look silly now after 7 years of doing it to not actually have a plan to effectuate it. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about Trump and what he can do to help Chicago, now, that's always the conservative talking point.
Chicago.
Yeah, Chicago.
And none of them even will go to Chicago.
You know, I lived in Chicago for 3 years, 47 the Drexel, lovely
city. 6 years.
Wonderful place. People make it sound like it's just this place of this death, detritus, and destruction. But what we can do is stop the Mexican drug gangs from bringing in drugs. There are no cocaine fields in Chicago. There's no poppy fields in Chicago. We have to control those issues.
Well, actually, on the guns.
Guns
that they get them all from Indiana, which actually we'll talk about on Monday's show as a new report that break all this sort of thing down. I got to go to a break. We come back, we'll talk the Atlanta council race. Big endorsement by the mayor there as well. Plus, we'll hear from Jason Williams, of course. His lifestyle out of control due to alcohol, gun death involving someone at his home. Now, he's trying to help others with substance abuse, and Bishop T.D. Jakes in this hour as well. All that, News One Now on TV One.
Don't leave.
My audience knows very well what we talk about.
I know the consequences.
A second hour of News One Now starts next.
Are you serious?
Don't you just love it when there's video?
News One Now continues on TV One.
Jason Williams was an NBA star until he broke his leg, ending his career in 1999. And then, of course, he then went on to a broadcasting career where folks said he was going to be one of the best. But alcohol was a problem, which played a role and was determined to be an accidental shooting at his home that left a limousine driver dead in 2002. Williams spent 18 months in prison as a result of the accident, and he is now focusing on rebounding from addiction and helping others in the process. I recently sat down with him as we discussed his Rebound Institute, an addiction recovery facility in Florida.
I have to take responsibility I've done for my actions. I'm not blaming alcohol for what happened. I'm blaming me for being reckless. I apologize to Mr. Christofi's family. I came home one day and had an accident in my house and act like a coward and try to cover it up and accidentally took the life of a man who's been putting his life back together, and that's not a day or maybe not even an hour that goes by that I don't think about that. So I'm just trying to do what I can to be a better person and help others, or act like I'm helping others while they're helping me, really, and fight with my struggles.
When you think about just, geez, the last 15 years, right. Take it 20 years. I mean, here, yeah. Someone, top of the game in terms of basketball, then you retire, and then everybody's talking about, oh my goodness, just this, oh, he's gonna be a television star, everything there, and then these things change.
Right.
And as you think back on all of that, you think back on the house, the marriage, the family, again, how people see you, what do you say to people who say, man, there's no way in the world I could have gotten through losing everything?
Mm-hmm. Well, the enemy is me. That, you know, and I have a disease that tells me I don't have a disease. I'm an alcoholic. And I have to do things to help other people. And they think I'm helping them, but they are actually helping me. So almost 2 years ago, I was sitting up in a cabin. I just took away from the world and went up and on 300 acres, sitting up there and just bugging out and drinking and just got away from everything. And Charles Oakley and Chris Mullen came up there and said, Jay, you got to do something, man. You got to go to treatment. You got to get yourself back in. You're a very gregarious person. You have to be around people. You can't isolate. So I went down to Florida and I got treatment at a place, and they did a pretty good job, but it was some things I saw there that wasn't correct. that I didn't think. I thought we could improve on it. And I know I have to be busy. So we started this center called Rebound Institute. You know, you can call the phone and you probably get me. It's a very small boutique kind of place with some of the best clinical staff in the country. And we do outdoor adventure therapy. You know, yesterday we went scuba diving. Everybody works for a scuba diver certified. Day before we went skydiving. Day before that we were on hydroplane boards and shooting up softball, golf, tennis. And we don't do this just so you can have fun and learn to laugh again and be sober. We do this to overcome barriers.
There have been several NBA players who have gone to teams and said, I need to step away.
Right.
And fans are going, yo, man, what the hell are you doing? We got a season. We got games to win. But the fan doesn't understand that NBA ball player's life. As you think back to all the times after games, mm-hmm. going out, drinking, partying, a lot of people don't realize a lot of these teams, especially used to be really bad, had alcohol on the planes,
right.
on the buses, always there. What do you say now to cats to say, look, this is me today. I can see where you might be going.
Well, the best way to explain it to them is just look at me. You know, I had everything. You know, I was on top of the world and I was doing what you were doing. You know, I was playing basketball. I had everything, and the only thing that took that away from me was alcohol. So, you know, just let, most guys would just say, hey man, you know, that was in my past. For me, when my kids go to school, and every time I do a show like this, they got to go to school and say, oh man, your dad, yeah, the Jason Williams, yeah, he's a good player. Oh, he's the one that had the accident. Oh, he's the alcoholic. So I'm pulling back wounds. So I'm hurting my family. It's that ripple effect. When you throw that bobber in the Placid Lake, that one little bobber changes the whole lake. And that's how it does with this. And this is a disease that tells me I don't have a disease, and every time I think I'm gonna conquer it, you know, something else happened. But God has been so good to me, and with this 12 steps that I'm working on, is that, you know, as soon as I feel like I got it, or I'm feeling bad, that same way, they're the same, because you know, when you reward yourself when things are going good, and when things are doing bad, you reward yourself. So right when I get into that area, God delivers me somebody for 45 days. And I go, wow, whew, I needed that. 45 days, I'm gonna take care of Roland's family. I'm gonna take care of this person. I know for 45 days, I gotta be crisp and clean. And then guess what? When I start feeling bad again, 45 days, somebody brings them back to me. I was a very good basketball player, very good construction guy, not a very good husband, not a very good father. These are the things that would haunt me. But one thing, Roland, I'm very good at is letting people help me stay on the straight and narrow. So when you come down and you send somebody to me, I'm not helping them. They're helping me, and I don't know it. Mm-hmm. I'm only 22 months sober. I'm not a guru on this, but I put together the best staff, the clinical staff, Harvard. You know, we got people that look like us, very diverse staff down there. So I take you in the morning, and my staff takes you in the afternoon, and you go to clinical, and we don't believe that you have to be in one of these cheap hotels or cheap houses.
Got it.
We got it all together. We spent a tremendous amount of money to build your self-esteem and get you back into society.
Another great athlete who's doing the same thing you're doing is Hollywood Henderson.
Yes.
Have you had conversations with him?
No, not yet. But now that you told me that, I played golf with Hollywood, you know, about 4 or 5 years ago.
And he has a facility down in Austin, Texas.
Yep. And that's what I'm saying. Find somebody. I'm there 18 hours a day because I have to, because I come off the rails if I'm not working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I leave here. I'm going back. We get back at 4:30 because, you know, they booked me, you know, we on a budget. You know, so we got 3 or 4 different flights that I got to get on to get back.
I understand.
So when I get back, I go straight to the clients. You know why? Because with my teammates, I go back to my teammates there, which we call, you know, which actually are clients, mm-hmm. because I have to be in that realm. So I have to be around people that scuba dive, snorkel. What we doing tomorrow, Jay? We playing tennis? Oh, no. You going to teach us how to play golf? Let's do that. And then we hang out together. And then I forget about those friends that I have who are waiting on 5 o'clock in Wall Street and all that to close up so we can up to a bar.
So you have the activities, plus you have your sessions, plus, yep. So you have all of that.
And then we have our 12-step meeting.
Got it.
Yep. It's just all came together, man.
How can folks get more information?
You just call 1-877-2-REBOUND or reboundinstitute.com.
Audio. All right, folks, we had an audio issue there. Sorry about that. So we'll get that fixed. Coming up next on News One Now, we'll chat with Bishop T.D. Jakes about his new book, Soar. Entrepreneurs, you might want to hear this. That's next.
So you want the truth? Well, we got it.
That's how I talk. God knows it. I'm just straight.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
A new book by Bishop T.D. Jakes is going to take you from just having a vision to knowing how to see it through. It is called SOAR, Build Your Vision from the Ground Up. He joins us right now from our studios in New York City. Bishop Jakes, good to see you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
All right, Bishop. So I'm going to start this way. Here's the thing that drives me crazy. And I was just in the break talking about this. We're dealing with my niece. I ain't got a problem saying it because I talk about it on social media as well. Bishop, what drives me crazy is when you see folks who say, I want to do this, this, this. And then God gives them this vision. And then they do nothing because it doesn't come to them in the perfect way they see it, then they say, well, that's not really it. And it just drives me crazy.
Well, you have hit the substratum of why I wrote the book. So many people have got their life on hold waiting on a bolt of lightning to strike or their rich uncle to die or this or that or the other. They don't understand that you have to use what you've got on the level that you've on to start the process of building your vision, whatever that vision may be. And that's what I'm really tutoring in this book and mentoring is how to start when you don't have everything perfect and everything's not there as if you would like to have it.
So a few weeks ago, so again, my niece who says she wants to go into film. So I know lots of directors and producers. And so one day we were talking in June and I called my man Reggie Hutland and he chatted with her. Well, we were here at Howard University a few weeks ago and he said, hey, how's it going? And she said, well, a lot of times I'm looking for inspiration. He said, inspiration? A job is inspiration. And I think, and again, when we talk about this idea of a vision, I talk to so many people like my niece, whether they're millennials or Gen Xers or others, who go, well, I'm just not feeling inspired. Getting your butt up and doing something should inspire you. Talk about how achieving personal success and just doing it should inspire you, not just something that's just going to fall out at the sky.
You know, I think that part of this crisis is a result of people who look at people like me and you and others who are doing something. They see the results, they don't see the process.
Uh-oh, preach! Come on!
They totally underestimate the behind-the-scenes work that goes into it, how many hours you're moving and traveling and going, and when they find out the work, they're not attracted to it. They want to eat the cake, but they don't want to grind the meal.
Sustained! Bishop, I use you in my speeches all the time, and I want you to talk about this here. I said, y'all keep looking at Bishop T.D. Jakes and the Potter's House and the ministry and movies and a talk show, but y'all don't want to talk about when he was digging ditches in West Virginia. Y'all don't want to talk about his wife having to deal with the food stamps and the government cheese. Y'all don't want to talk about when Bishop wore them polyester suits. Oh, now, Bishop, because you talked about it. No.
And that's true.
Bishop, I use that to people, and because you talked about it when you had that one suit
when we were in April,
when you said you had that one suit, and you said, I ain't want to show them the lining because the lining was gone. People want to ignore you walking through the valley, and they want to talk about being on the mountain.
That's exactly right. And it takes all of that and more. You have to believe in your dream. You have to work and work hard to get it done. In my book, I talk about putting yourself around the right people so that you're not wasting and expending energy on people who are draining you rather than depositing in you. You know, you really have to have a great deal of focus to do this. It's not always about having a great deal of money. It's about having a great deal of focus and energy and tenacity. It's not always about having a lot of money. As you said, we had nothing. My lights were off, my water was off, they repossessed my car when we started. When we started my business and we started traveling with plays, the first couple of plays, we almost went bankrupt. I mean, they were not successful at all. But I say all the time, you'll win if you don't quit. That's what SOAR is all about, telling you where to put your efforts, where to put your energies, and then how tenacious you have to be in order to accomplish what you're trying to do.
Now how do you also deal with God's will in this book. You talked before about everything was great, man. Y'all had this wonderful house, and your wife had these new drapes, and they were wonderful. And then you came home and said, the Lord is saying it's time for us to move to Dallas. And for a moment, your wife was like, he lost his mind. Does he not see all the drapes? We just got into this big old house again.
Yeah.
Vision, you were living a great life, but God said, no, I got something else that's greater than what you have here, but you had to be obedient to leave.
You have to be willing to get out of your nest, to get out of your comfort zone and go to the next dimension. I really talk about in the book about being on different levels of success, and you can have accomplishment and peek out at a place that destiny really wants to take you to the next level. Many people don't know, but TD Jakes Enterprises, my for-profit company, was existing in West Virginia before I ever even came to Dallas to go to the Potter's House. I had to pick up both entities, for-profit, not-for-profit, and move to a place scared to death. But your greatest miracle and your greatest success is always in your scary place. If you stay in your safe place, you will never achieve it. You have to be willing to get in your scary place in order to grow to the next level.
Bishop, the other day I was asked to do a Skype with a class out of Illinois. And they asked me about this idea of success. And what I told them was, I actually live streamed it too. I said, what I do, I'm not trying to do it for someone else's approval. What I try to do, I push myself so hard because I want to see how far I can go, how I can learn more, and I get gratification from that. So I don't even need you, somebody else to say, Roland, that was phenomenal. No, for me, it was about, man, I was here, and man, how did I learn this or do that? How does that also play into the idea of your book, Soar and Vision, and making that happen?
First of all, I couldn't agree with you more. I tell people all the time, I wanted to know what was in me. There was this nagging, gnawing feeling that there was more in me than what my situation reflected. I didn't want to die with a question mark over my head, wondering what would have happened had I really pushed harder and found out what was in me. So it is about self-exploration. God puts his treasure in earthen vessels, but we have to get it out. And so that's very, very important. And I think one of the things that is important in the book, when I wrote this book, I based it around the Wright brothers and them building an airplane from inside a bicycle shop. They didn't have what they needed. They didn't have a degree. They didn't have the money. They didn't have the manufacturing place. All they had was a dream. But tenaciously built this big thing in a small place. And the reason that they achieved what they were able to do is because they believed in what they saw on the inside. To me, success is not a big house, it's not a big car, it's not a jet, it's not a diamond ring. Success is the birthing of the vision you have on the inside until it is standing right in front of your face.
Folks, the book is called Soar. That's right. Build your vision from the ground up by Bishop T.D. Jakes. Bishop, always good seeing you.
Thank you, Roland. God bless.
All right, folks, we'll be back. News One Now on TV One, just a moment.
Your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America.
I don't bend, I don't break.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
All right, incumbent mayor Atlanta, Kasim Reed, has endorsed someone in the race, City Councilwoman Keisha Lance Bottoms.
And I want folks to know that I'm going to do everything I can between now and November 7th and December 5th to see that Keisha Lance Bottoms becomes my successor, that a woman becomes the 60th mayor of the city of Atlanta.
Decisions for all of us, and we can't leave that up to chance. Every
time there was Bottoms released an ad yesterday featuring Reed, who is promising to make stops at 40 barbershops, nail shops, and beauty salons over the weekend as early voting for the November 7th election begins on Monday. You got 12 people in the race, Robert. You're there in Atlanta who's running. Is this big?
No, this is not big at all. I think the biggest impediment to Keisha Lance Bottoms winning is the supporter Kasim Reed, who is currently supporting her in this race. Kasim Reed has done more to destroy black churches in Atlanta than any white Republican could ever do. He's currently working on trying to turn Morris Brown's campus into a movie studio. He's done more for gentrification to move black people outside of the city of Atlanta. He has attacked every black man in the race, from Vincent Fort to John Eaves to Kwanzaa Hall to Caesar Mitchell. So I think him going to barbershops in the hood that he has not helped in the last 8 years is not going to be what pushes Keisha Lance Bottoms over the top.
Shannon, but here's what's interesting, what you have here, though. You look at the most recent poll, the numbers have changed. She's actually increased support in the polls. Now is running right behind the white candidate, Mary Norwood. And so it's so this, now coming on the heels of that, could change that race. And again, early voting is Monday.
You know, a lot of folks don't really pay attention, you know, below the surface level. So on the surface, they're going to see the current endorsing who he'd like to see be the next. And that's all they're going to see. They're not going to see what he's done, what he hasn't done, memories are short, all that. They're going to see the current saying this should be the next.
Scott, what you also have here, again, you got 12 people running. When you have that many people running, then you have, of course, Norwood, who is in double digits in a huge way. This is all about separating the pack. And at the end of the day, if you're one of the 12 of the other 11 candidates, your goal is to get to the runoff. Any bump of 1%, 2% actually separates you from the pack.
Yeah, I think so. You know, Kasim Reed is a great Kappa man, and I think really been a great man.
Ain't that many though, but go ahead.
Yeah, but he is a great Kappa man. You know, I understand the numbers are up, though. Crime is down. It's one of the most well-run cities. If you take the polling on his popularity and what he's done for the city over 8 years, I think his endorsement can make a difference. You know, when you have multiple candidates, the bottom line is, and I've run for office before, is that it's an open seat, then whoever's got the best ground game, whoever's best organized, is the one that's going to be successful.
Well, of course, yesterday we had Ernie Suggs of the Land Journal Constitution on the show talking about the whole issue of turnout. That is something that matters. And again, I'll say it again, mm-hmm. folks. You had, of course, when you had a race last time, you had 14% turnout. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I can't accept 14% turnout in Atlanta, 25% turnout in Birmingham, 25% turnout in the race, in the mayoral race election. We can't keep talking about Donald Trump, Republicans in the House, in the Senate, in these places, and then we're not voting in local elections. We are more impacted by what is happening in local elections. And so if there's a local election in your city, you better be registered and you better vote, because it doesn't make sense for us to have numerical power and then we don't use it. That, to me, is an abomination. Black folks in Atlanta, get off your butt, go register, and go vote. Coming up next, we'll talk about race and affirmative action. Wait till you hear George W. Bush talk about it. Next.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Good morning, folks. Second hour of News One Now. Coming up, we'll talk about the issue of race and legacy in college admissions. You know, it was a few years ago when President George W. Bush had something to say about that. We'll talk about that on the show. Also, Marshall opens across theaters on tomorrow, and we'll talk with someone who wrote a book about the legacy of Thurgood Marshall. Also, the Justice Department's probe, we talked about affirmative action on that deal, dealing with Harvard. Again, which I show you the George W. Bush interview, you're really going to get a kick out of that one. Also, folks, Hollywood distracted by Harvey Weinstein's scandal. Jay-Z is saying, you know what, I need to get out of this mess. I don't want to be in business with home brother. Plus, Bishop T.D. Jakes talks about his book, Soar. And, of course, it's What the Hell Thursday. In Trump's world, it's What the Hell every day. It's time to bring the funk. News One Now, TV One. Race, colleges, affirmative action has always been a huge issue in America. Black folks have been left out of our universities for quite some time. But one of the things that changed that was universities being forced with affirmative action to diversify, to include more of us. So yesterday, of course, on this show, we talked about the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law going after the Trump Department of Justice because they are trying to investigate Harvard University and their admissions policies. Now, they don't care about criminal justice reform. They don't care about cops losing their mind. No, they're more focused on affirmative action because in their minds, they believe that, oh my goodness, all of these white kids are losing opportunities. You still might remember, that was a white woman who sued the University of Texas saying it was because of those blacks and Latinos that she could not get into the University of Texas. Well, when they went all the way to the Supreme Court, where she lost, they discovered that there were other white students who had lower grades than her who got in. See, that's what happens in America. They sort of just blame them. It's got to be them. They the reason I didn't get in. Nah, it could be you. And so we talked about this on yesterday. I wanted to play this for you because this took place in 2004 at the Uni Journalists of Color Convention here in Washington, D.C. Four of us, Native Americans, Hispanics, Asians, African-American journalists, got a chance to ask questions of President George W. Bush. NABJ chose me to represent the National Association of Black Journalists. And at this time, the Michigan affirmative action case was going before the United States Supreme Court. So I chose to ask Bush about it.
Mr. President, you said, quote, quotas, you said, quote, quotas are an unfair system for all, unquote, with regards to your opposition to affirmative action.
No, whoa. With regard to my opposition to quota systems.
To quotas, okay. But I've never heard you speak against legacy. Now, the president of Texas A&M, Robert Gates, said that he would not use race in admissions, and then he later said he would not use legacy. If you say it's a matter of merit and not race, shouldn't colleges also get rid of legacy? And because that's not based upon merit, that's based upon if my daddy or my granddaddy went to my college.
Yeah, I thought you were referring to my legacy.
That's why I allowed you to go ahead and bring it out.
Yeah. Well, in my case, I had to knock on a lot of doors to follow the old man's footsteps. If what you're saying is there going to be special treatment for people? We're going to have a special exception for certain people and a system that's supposed to be fair? I agree. I don't think there ought to be.
So the colleges should get rid of legacy?
Well, I think so, yeah. I think it ought to be based upon merit, and I think it also be based upon... And I think colleges need to work hard for diversity. No, don't get me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get me wrong. You said against affirmative action is what you said. You put words in my mouth. What I am for is diversity.
I just read the speech, Mr. President.
What speech?
In terms of when you came out against the Michigan affirmative action policy.
No, I said I was against quotas.
So you support affirmative action, but not quotas.
I support colleges affirmatively taking action to get more minorities in their school.
That's a long headline, Mr. President.
I support diversity. I don't support quotas. I think quotas are wrong. I think quotas are wrong for people. Do a lot of people.
But just to be clear, you believe that colleges should not use legacy.
I think colleges ought to use merit in order for people to get in, and I think they ought to use a merit system like the one I put out.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all. Thanks for having me.
5 seconds. All right, folks, joining us now via Skype from Nashville, Tennessee, is Tim Wise, an anti-racism activist. Tim, after that questioning of President George W. Bush, the New York Times did a story, and the next day, Yale, Harvard, all those colleges, they got tons of phone calls from concerned folks there saying, oh my goodness, are y'all going to get rid of legacy? And it's amazing how a lot of these people who love talking about affirmative action don't want anybody to touch legacy, where white students today are benefiting from segregation because they're getting a leg up when African Americans and Hispanics can't use legacy because our parents and grandparents couldn't have gone to those schools.
Right. Well, yeah, and this has been an issue for a long time that very few people want to talk about. There are about twice as many at elite colleges, about twice as many white students who are getting into these schools with lower test scores, frankly, than the average, with lower grade point averages than the average, but who were getting in either because of direct legacy, that is to say a parent or grandparent went to that school, or because of some other type of connections or pulling strings. There are twice as many of those whites getting in despite lower qualifications and having connections than there are black and brown folks getting in with even a little bit of help from affirmative action. So clearly, when folks file lawsuits claiming either that white people like Abigail Fisher were supposedly disadvantaged because of affirmative action, or this new lawsuit against Harvard, which is trying to make Asian Americans the victims and saying that they're being bumped, what's being ignored is that, in fact, whatever bumping is happening usually on behalf of better connected, richer white people. That's what we need to be talking about, on behalf of all people of color, and I should point out, on behalf of working class white folks as well, who often are bumped because their daddy doesn't know the right person. It hurts everyone except the very elite.
Well, and that's what's interesting, because you have these same working class white folks who love them some Donald Trump, but Jared Kushner's daddy bought his way into Harvard. We see that all the time. And again, it is amazing to me when you talk to folks. Again, they can't stand affirmative action. They can't stand the use of race even having a factor in it. But then they say, oh, no. Don't you touch legacy. And then you hear people say, well, slavery was such a long time ago. I keep reminding them, if you are a student today and legacy is being used in admissions, you today are benefiting directly from Jim Crow.
Right. But let me also say this. It's not just legacy. Here's the thing. When you are, on average, we know, for instance, that the SAT and other standardized test scores, the biggest single correlation with that is your zip code, right? As in where you live, the quality of the school that you attended K through 12. So ultimately, it isn't just formal legacy. We have such a profoundly unequal K-12 system that by definition, you are going to have a disproportionate number of white folks who are going to test better because they had better access. You're going to have a disproportionate number of black and brown folks who test lower, irrespective of their real potential. So even that, even using a quote unquote traditional merit criteria, when the history and the context within which we accumulate merit is not equal, actually perpetuates injustice. Colleges have got to be free to examine merit in a broad way, and part of that means if I'm a person of color and I've overcome obstacles, or a poor white person for that matter, and I've overcome obstacles to get that, let's say, 1100 on the SAT. No, it may not be a 1500, but that's more impressive. Getting an 1100 where I didn't have any AP classes, I didn't have any honors classes, right, is a lot more impressive than somebody getting a 14 or a 1500 at a prep school. So we got to let colleges think about merit in a holistic way that actually produces equity and diversity, not this traditional way that basically privileges the privileged.
And that's what we're seeing here. And this is also, to me, where you begin. But see, I'm going to change that. Tim, but even goes further than that. In Texas, when they had the Hopwood decision there, where race was even more so used in the current method. Same thing, right. A lawsuit against the University of Texas. The Fifth Circuit ruled against the University of Texas. They went back and changed it. So here's right. What happened. The black legislators said, okay, we got to figure something out. Then they realized that, to your point earlier, the rural white kids were not getting into the University of Texas, Texas right. A&M, Texas Tech, North Texas, the major state universities. So the minority legislators got with the rural white legislators and said, we're going to do top 10%. That is, right. If you finish in the top 10% of your graduating class, that's best of the best, you will right. be automatically admitted to any state university in Texas. Well, guess right. what happened? Those rich white parents said, well, wait a minute. My right. child goes right. to a much more rigorous school. And so it's right. unfair for that right. less than a poor white kid or black kid or Hispanic kid to get into the University of Texas because right. my child takes 3 and 4 AP honors classes. So what did right. they do? The University of Texas had them slash the number of people who were admitted under the top 10 by saying, well, you know, we don't have enough room to be able to pick more different students. And so even right. when you have a non-race-based model, you right. still have rich white parents or well-to-do white parents who still say, nah, we ain't down with this because they getting a hookup and we're not.
Right. Yeah, there's a mentality of entitlement among the affluent students who go to prep schools. And again, keep in mind, you know, these kids like Abigail Fisher, whoever it is, the fact that they went to a quote unquote more rigorous school and took more AP class, they didn't earn that. They got born into a family that could afford that. How in the world is somebody entitled to that education? You got lucky. You're no more entitled to that than someone else is to blame for the fact that they got born in a rural, poor area or in the hood or wherever it is. And so we've got to have an entire entire rethink about, we always talk about poor folks having an entitlement mentality and people of color having an entitlement mentality. The entitlement mentality in this country is rich white folks who are upset that apparently it's not enough to get a gentleman C at Yale the way that some former presidents were able to do, or it's not enough to pull some strings and take all the good slots, or it's not enough in Donald Trump's case, even though he wasn't born as affluent, let's say, as George W. Bush, to be able to get into Penn Business School because the admissions officer allowed a transfer from Fordham or wherever he was because he knew his brother or something. I mean, this is what rich white folks always do. And then they blame black folks and brown folk for not getting enough of the goodies that they used to get when actually it's other white folks who were taking their stuff.
Tim Wise, always a pleasure. We appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
You bet, man.
Our panel, A. Scott Bolden, legal analyst, chairman of the National Bar Association PAC, Pastor Shannon Wright, third vice chair of the Maryland GOP, Robert Petillo, attorney and host of CBS Radio Atlanta. Again, I tell you, it's always hilarious to me when I see this conversation, and I'm going, y'all act like y'all ain't got the hookup.
But let's say all that's true. Great discussion, right? Fairly one-sided. But if none of that works,
how was it one-sided? It was true.
So truth has that side.
Right.
But you got to make a side.
You sound like Trump with the two sides.
Well, no. What I'm saying is that all makes sense. The admissions process in colleges across this country is difficult enough. I agree with everything that was said in that interview, right? So then what's the answer? What was missing from that interview is, what's the answer? How do you make it more fair for everybody?
No, first of all,
top three
okay,
things
first of
you
all,
would change.
Okay, here's the first thing, okay? Let's get rid of this nonsense where it's more fair for everybody. Because college is the end of the process, Shannon and Robert, because here's the deal. If you screwed me from pre-K through 12th grade, don't act like all of a sudden we're on an even playing field. And I do believe that when you have predominantly white institutions that are predominantly white for a reason, which is the legacy of Jim Crow, white supremacy, and slavery, then you need to be able to utilize race in your admissions to say, wait a minute, let me look at how can I diversify my force. What's interesting is when I discussed the Michigan affirmative action case, who is one of the folks who signed a different amicus briefs? Who was it? The military. You had Norman Schwarzkopf and others who were saying, in the military, we know what diversity and inclusion has meant. What you have here, you have folks who want to keep the same system. Let's have white students be able to go to the elite institutions or go to colleges, and the rest of y'all can go to trade schools, y'all can go do some other stuff, and this promotes the inequities
but
in America.
That's
Robert.
The problem. What's the
answer? I think one of the big things that we have to do.
I just told you, allow race to be used. Go.
Well, one of the big things we have to realize is that the Supreme Court has ruled on this for the last 30 years, that race and diversity is a compelling interest. And what we have to make sure that when we're monitoring what Trump is doing with the Supreme Court, what he's doing with the over 100 federal judge vacancies that he has to fill, I think he's filled about 37 so far, is what their opinions are going to be on affirmative action going forward and what we can do to combat that, making sure we're keeping an eye on that. We always get distracted by the fireworks coming out of the White House, not realizing that we really have to be working on what's going on in the court system, filing those briefs, filing those lawsuits to keep them going. But also, let's make sure that we stop lionizing and pretending that their schools are better than ours. We have to be advocates for our HBCUs, advocates to get the best and brightest into our schools, because guess what? The most racist school on earth will go get the fastest running back in the country, regardless of color. They'll get the tallest person, get dunk a basketball, shoot a three, no matter what. So how about they come to us, because we're producing the best and brightest at our own HBCUs, and make sure we concentrate in-house on building up our communities.
Shannon.
Mm-hmm. You know, I listened to a lot of what you gentlemen said, and you in particular, I'm sorry. How are we supposed to get the best and the brightest in our schools, HBCUs, right, when the schools that are educating our kids don't teach them, in a lot of cases, how to read or do arithmetic? So you want to look at the college level, but you got to make that education thing a multi-pronged approach.
Boom.
You got to go back. You got to make sure that you got to make sure that child is going into an elementary school, that they, when they come out, they are
right,
prepared.
We're talking about the context of higher education.
No. But she's right, and that's the problem with this whole discussion. We want to isolate colleges as if they're separate and distinct, but college is the end result. If you ignore high schools, middle schools, and elementary schools, then you're going to have the same problem in colleges, which is why when I did my school choice event down in Selma, Alabama, one of the few black female athletic directors, she said, They're not even sending scouts to recruit athletes in Selma because of new NCAA requirements. They can't even make the grade. So to your point, we're even losing those opportunities mm-hmm. because not being able to make the grade. And so we'll see what happens, of course, with this DOJ investigation. Coming up next, folks, we'll talk about the movie Marshall. Opens tomorrow. Phenomenal movie about Thurgood Marshall. We'll talk with the author of a book about the great lawyer and Supreme Court justice. That's next. News 1 Now, TV 1.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News 1 Now with Roland Martin. Every weekday morning at 7 on TV 1.
The movie Marshall about Thurgood Marshall opens in theaters tomorrow. I want all of you to go see it. It is an unbelievable film starring Chadwick Boseman, produced and directed by Reggie Hutland. I recently hosted a Q&A, one of three I did, with these two gentlemen. Here's some of that Q&A.
You gentlemen are making a big mistake.
This here is Mr. Thurgood Marshall. Man is an attorney. You will treat him with the respect that he deserves.
Glad to see all of you for this special screening of the great movie Marshall. Who enjoyed the film? All right, so here's the deal. We have some online questions. I'm going to get to those secondary. I'm going to take some of your questions. Now, let me be real clear. I'm about to walk around. I'm going here, then here. And so, don't yell, don't do all that sort of stuff. Here's the other rule. I got a microphone. You don't need to touch it.
What is the most intimidating part or the main difference for you, Chadwick, between playing a historical superhero, if you will, versus a fictional character?
they're both intimidating. What do you, like, yeah, I mean, maybe if I play something other than Black Panther, I can answer that question. But yeah, I think they're both intimidating in their own ways. That's really the only answer I can give you.
I authored a book, but I've been told that you required the cast to read. This is the only biography of Thurgood Marshall authorized by his family. And I want to autograph and give you autographed copies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, folks, I want to talk with that guy right there, Larry Gibson, the author of Young Thurgood, The Making of a Supreme Court Justice. He joins us via phone from Baltimore. You, with this particular book here, you talk about a young Thurgood. Most people know about Brown versus Board of Education. He was on the Supreme Court. What would you say, something that's really important about Thurgood Marshall the average person does not know and understand?
Well, part of the reason I wrote this book was to change some writing, some misperceptions that people have. For example, I discovered that his family, just growing up, was just simply poorer than I had been led to believe. His mother is described in most writings as a school teacher, but she was a substitute teacher and not working most of the time. The father worked irregularly. They didn't even have their own home until he was in high school. Up to high school, they lived upstairs in an uncle's house. So there was, and then I put in the book a whole chapter about the struggle financially of just getting him through college. I even printed some of the letters that his mother wrote, just pleading with the people at Lincoln to let him come back that semester, and it shows how much he worked just to get an education. I mean, he at Lincoln, at the entire time he was there, worked at nights in the school bakery, and then as soon as the school year was over, he went to work as a dining car waiter on railroads. So I think that there was a misperception that many has as to his economic situation growing up. It was a very tight economic situation for him.
Obviously, someone, a brilliant lawyer, but he wasn't the greatest student coming up.
Well, that was the second misconception that I wanted to correct in his book. That's why in the book I put all of his academic record. He was an excellent student at every step. The book has in it his transcript from high school, every course he ever took from the high school through to college, his entire college transcript, and his entire law school transcript. He graduated at high school near the top of his class. He graduated with honors from undergraduate school, and he was the top student in his class at law school. Thurgood did a lot to perpetuate this misimpression of not being a serious student. He was, as you can view yourself by looking at the actual grades and courses throughout his career, his educational career, a really good student. You can see the grades yourself.
Thurgood is not his actual name.
Well, that is correct. His name was at birth Thurgood, and another exhibit
Thurgood?
In my book, Thurgood, Thorough. It was a family name. That was his grandfather's name. It actually was his father's, not his father, his grandfather's name, and he had an uncle by that name. He decided that he wanted to change it around the second grade. But what I have in the book is the official government birth certificate that shows that actually nothing was done towards changing it until Thurgood Marshall was 40 years old. What happened then is his father went down to the Vital Records office here in Maryland and asked them to change it. There was no official filing. They just drew a line through. It was actually a red line through the original name and wrote in the word Thurgood. So his name probably always remained Thurgood when he was christened in the Episcopal Church. That's at age, not christened, confirmed at age 14. The Episcopalians have the name Thurgood, and that image is also placed in the book.
Larry, you can't see it right now. The video that we're showing is from the LBJ Library when Thurgood Marshall, when he... was named to the Supreme Court. You saw the photo there of his wife, but and just like Scott Bolden next to me, Thurgood wasn't a good student in school. It wasn't until, but it was meeting his future wife who caused him to get serious about school. That's like a lot of brothers. They messing around until they meet a woman.
But it's inaccurate.
That's why I wanted you to speak to that. So go ahead.
Thurgood was a raconteur. He loved to tell stories. And so he perpetuated much of that notion. And also, for some reason, I've known many guys who went to Lincoln during that period. Every one of them I met bragged about how little they studied. There was something about wanting to perpetuate this image of not being serious when that's simply not the case with Thurgood Marshall. And again, one doesn't have to take my word for it. Look at his academic record. In my book, I produce images of every grade and course from the ninth grade in high school through the completion of his law school career.
I got a couple of quick questions, Scott. I'm gonna have the lawyers ask first. Come on, Scott. What's your question?
Dr. Gibson, good talking to you. I think one thing, and I don't know whether it's in the book or not or in the movie yet, is can you talk a little bit about the legacy of Thurgood Marshall in the context of inspiring thousands, if not millions, of lawyers who happen to be African American because they either went to Howard Law School because of him or because of Charles Hamilton Houston?
Larry, I got about 20 seconds for the answer so I can
Absolutely.
Get to all three questions, so go ahead.
No question. Thurgood Marshall has been called, I think properly so, the most important American lawyer of the 20th century mm-hmm. because of his impact not only on black lawyers, but on a whole school of lawyers. I mean, he created the concept of civil rights lawyer.
Got it.
One could actually call him the first national civil rights lawyer. Yes, Charlie Houston got it going, but remember, Charlie was at the NAACP for
right.
only 2 years. Well, no, 3 years. I mean, the person who did his Thurgood Marshall, and what my next book does is picks up from this book, which ends in 1938, and goes through 54 and shows his influence state by state.
Larry,
on lawyer.
Hold tight one second. Robert, real quick, your question, then a quick answer, then Shannon.
All right, just real quick, what do you think lawyers today who are fighting this Kaepernick fight can learn from the battle for Brown versus Board of Education, the planning, the strategy, the tactics that were used then?
About 20 seconds, Larry. Go ahead.
That it takes time. You've got to stay on the case. I mean, Thurgood Marshall lost his first school desegregation case in 1936 in Baltimore County. It took until 1954. And the second is the battles tend not to be permanent.
Got it.
We are now refighting the voting rights matter that we thought was settled.
Shannon, you from Maryland? He's from Maryland. Question.
So, in looking at the history and the legacy, what would you say is the most important thing to say to someone, a young person now, that's getting ready to start their career?
Larry, 20 seconds.
Okay. Learn and master control of the language and expression. That's what Thurgood Marshall was debating through high school and through college. Really prepared him, but it wasn't just the speaking, it was mastering the words. If you look at his academic career, what did he study? He studied Greek, he studied Latin, he studied rhetoric. So get the tools. If you want to be effective, get the basic tools. And if it's verbal persuasion or it's written persuasion, it's that kind of preparation.
I got
then you can go in and be an advocate.
Larry Gibson, author of the book, Young Thurgood, The Making of, pull the book up, please. We have the cover. Thank you very much. The Making of a Supreme Court Justice. Larry, thanks so much. We appreciate it.
All right, Roland. Hope you enjoyed the book.
All right. Thank you very much, sir. Don't forget, folks, Marshall opens in theaters tomorrow. Go see and take your family. Coming up next, we'll hear from Bishop T.D. Jakes about soaring, taking your vision, making it a reality. Next, News 1 Now, TV 1.
Your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America.
I don't bend, I don't break.
It's News 1 Now with Roland Martin.
A new book by Bishop T.D. Jakes is going to take you from just having a vision to knowing how to see it through. It is called Soar, Build Your Vision from the Ground Up. He joins us right now from our studios in New York City. Bishop Jakes, good to see you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
All right, Bishop. So I'm going to start this way. Here's the thing that drives me crazy. And I was just in the break talking about this. We're dealing with my niece. I ain't got a problem saying it because I talk about it on social media as well. Bishop, what drives me crazy is when you see folks who say, I want to do this, this, this. And then God gives them this vision and then they do nothing or because it doesn't come to them in the perfect way they see it, then they say, well, that's not really it. And it just drives me crazy.
Well, you have hit the substratum of why I wrote the book. So many people have got their life on hold waiting on a bolt of lightning to strike or their rich uncle to die or this or that or the other. They don't understand that you have to use what you've got on the level that you've on to start the process of building your vision, whatever that vision may be. And that's what I'm really tutoring in this book and mentoring is how to start when you don't have everything perfect and everything's not there as if you would like to have it.
So a few weeks ago, so again, my niece who says she wants to go into film. So I know lots of directors and producers. And so one day we were talking in June and I called my man Reggie Hutland and he chatted with her. Well, we were here in Howard University a few weeks ago and he said, hey, how's it going? And she said, well, a lot of times I'm looking for inspiration. He said, inspiration? A job is inspiration. And I think, and again, when we talk about this idea of a vision, I talk to so many people like my niece, whether they're millennials or Gen Xers or others, who go, well, I'm just not feeling inspired. Getting your butt up and doing something should inspire you. Talk about how achieving personal success and just doing it should inspire you, not just something that's just gonna fall out at the sky.
You know, I think that part of this crisis is a result of people who look at people like me and you and others who are doing something. They see the results, they don't see the process.
Uh-oh, preach!
There it is.
Come on!
They totally underestimate the behind-the-scenes work that goes into it, how many hours you're moving and traveling and going, and when they find out the work, they're not attracted to it. They want to eat the cake, but they don't want to grind the meal.
Sustained! Bishop, I use you in my speeches all the time, and I want you to talk about this here. I said, y'all keep looking at Bishop T.D. Jakes and the Potter's House and the ministry and movies and a talk show, but y'all don't want to talk about when he was digging ditches in West Virginia. Y'all don't want to talk about his wife having to deal with the food stamps and the government cheese. Y'all don't want to talk about when Bishop wore them polyester suits. Oh, not Bishop, because you talked about it. No.
And that's true.
Bishop, I use that to people, and because you talked about it when you had that one suit.
That's right. In April,
when you said you had that one suit, and you said I ain't want to show them the lining because the lining was gone. People want to ignore you walking through the valley, and they want to talk about being on the mountain.
That's exactly right. And it takes all of that and more. You have to believe in your dream. You have to work and work hard to get it done. In my book, I talk about putting yourself around the right people so that you're not wasting and expending energy on people who are draining you rather than depositing in you. You know, you really have to have a great deal of focus to do this. It's not always about having a great deal of money. It's about having a great deal of focus and energy and tenacity. It's not always about having a lot of money. As you said, we had nothing. My lights were off, my water was off. They repossessed my car when we started. When we started my business and we started traveling with plays, the first couple of plays, we almost went bankrupt. I mean, they were not successful at all. But I say all the time, you'll win if you don't quit. That's what SOAR is all about, telling you where to put your efforts, where to put your energies, and then how tenacious you have to be in order to accomplish what you're trying to do.
Now how do you also deal with God's will in this book? You talked before about everything was great, man. Y'all had this wonderful house, and your wife had these new drapes, and they were wonderful. And then you came home and said, the Lord is saying it's time for us to move to Dallas. And for a moment, your wife was like, he lost his mind. Does he not see all the drapes? We just got into this big old house again.
Yeah.
Vision, you were living a great life, but God said, no, I got something else that's greater than what you have here, but you had to be obedient to leave.
You have to be willing to get out of your nest, to get out of your comfort zone and go to the next dimension. I really talk about in the book about being on different levels of success, and you can have accomplishment and peek out at a place that destiny really wants to take you to the next level. Many people don't know, but T.D. Jakes Enterprises, my for-profit company, was existing in West Virginia before I ever even came to Dallas to go to the Potter's House. I had to pick up both entities, for-profit, not-for-profit, and move to a place scared to death. But your greatest miracle and your greatest success is always in your scary place. If you stay in your safe place, you will never achieve it. You have to be willing to get in your scary place in order to grow to the next level.
Bishop, the other day I was asked to do a Skype with a class out of Illinois. And they asked me about this idea of success. And I, what I told them was, I actually live streamed it too. I said, what I do, I'm not trying to do it for somebody else's approval. What I try to do, I push myself so hard because I want to see how far I can go, how I can learn more, and I get gratification from that. So I don't even need you, somebody else to say, Roland, that was phenomenal. No, for me, it was about, man, I was here, and man, how did I learn this or do that? How does that also play into the idea of your book, SOAR and Vision, and making that happen?
First of all, I couldn't agree with you more. I tell people all the time, I wanted to know what was in me. There was this nagging, gnawing feeling that there was more in me than what my situation reflected. I didn't want to die with a question mark over my head, wondering what would have happened had I really pushed harder and found out what was in me. So it is about self-exploration. God puts his treasure in earthen vessels, but we have to get it out. And so that's very, very important. And I think one of the things that is important in the book, when I wrote this book, I based it around the Wright brothers and them building an airplane from inside a bicycle shop. They didn't have what they needed. They didn't have a degree. They didn't have the money. They didn't have the manufacturing place. All they had was a dream. but tenaciously built this big thing in a small place. And the reason that they achieved what they were able to do is because they believed in what they saw on the inside. To me, success is not a big house. It's not a big car. It's not a jet. It's not a diamond ring. Success is the birthing of the vision you have on the inside until it is standing right in front of your face.
Folks, the book is called Soar. That's right. Build Your Vision from the Ground Up by Bishop T.D. Jakes. Bishop, always good seeing you.
Thank you, Roland. God bless.
All right, folks, we'll be back. News One Now and TV One just a moment.
Don't leave.
My audience knows very well what we talk about.
I know the consequences.
A second hour of News One Now starts next.
Are you serious?
Don't you just love it when there's video?
News One Now continues on TV One.
In Atlanta, Mayor Kasim Reed has endorsed City Councilwoman Keisha Lance Bottoms to be his replacement in the crowded mayoral race.
And I want folks to know that I'm going to do everything I can between now and November 7th and December 5th to see that Keisha Lance Bottoms becomes my successor, that a woman becomes the 60th mayor of the city of Atlanta.
12 people are running for mayor of Atlanta. She is one of those 12. Another city councilwoman, Mary Norwood, is leading according to the polls. And so we'll see what role this plays when it comes to her effort there. Again, 12 people are running. Election November 7th. Early voting starts on Monday. And we'll see what happens. But y'all better get out and vote in Atlanta. Let's go to Puerto Rico, where nearly 90% of that country is still without power almost 3 weeks after Hurricane Maria struck the island. Almost 47% not have phone service, and a third of potential water sources are undrinkable. The death toll also has risen to 45, with at least 113 people still unaccounted for. Plus, there's a growing public health threat with disease brought on by the conditions and hospitals operating at limited capacity. Critics are accusing the government of hiding information about the devastation in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. They say FEMA changed its disaster relief website to appear more positive than it actually is. But House Speaker Paul Ryan says the U.S. is doing everything it can to help.
We've got 17,000 personnel in Puerto Rico right now between FEMA and the military. And the disaster reserve fund, the disaster relief fund, is typically what finances that. And we've been burning through that pretty fast. That's why we need to put more money in the DIRF as soon as possible.
All right, folks. The Weinstein Company, this is our next story. The Weinstein Company, they fired Harvey Weinstein, one of their co-founders. Now Jay-Z wants to fire him as well. He's thinking about purchasing a stake in the Weinstein Company. Last week, the Weinstein Company, like I said, fired Harvey Weinstein after a number of accusations accusing him of sexual assault. Now Jay-Z is saying, what if I buy 23% interest in the film studio? TMZ reports Jay-Z wants to continue his relationship with the company. They are working on a Trayvon Martin documentary. Also, they helped him produce the Khalif Browder story. So we'll see what Jay-Z, always looking for a good opportunity. An unarmed black man paralyzed after a Pittsburgh police officer shot him during a traffic stop is promising to continue his fight for justice after two major court losses. It was 5 years ago when officers David Derbysh and Andrew Miller pulled over Leon Ford. At one point, Miller tried to yank Ford from the car. Then Derbysh, who was on the passenger side, claimed he spotted a gun, jumped in the car as Ford tried to get away and shot him 5 times. This week, a jury which had no black members cleared Miller of assault and battery, and they couldn't decide if Derbysh violated Ford's civil rights by using excessive force in shooting Ford. His attorneys want justice.
There is nothing reasonable about what those officers did to Leon. We're not at all surprised about the decision regarding Officer Miller. Officer Derbysh is wholly responsible for causing the harm to Leon and his lifelong injuries.
Ford released a statement that says the police pulled me over for no reason, mistook me for someone else and shot me. Before they shot me, they cursed at me, threatened and tortured me as if I was less than human. They claimed they saw a gun on me that did not exist. I am confident that the truth will come out again the next time a jury hears my case. And folks, it's just simple. Bottom line is, you still don't get justice even in a lot of these civil rights cases, real quick.
You know, the car pulling off is what the jury focused on.
As always.
But what you got to focus on as a jury, and if you're advocating in the case, is what happened before then. Because the car pulling off was really self-defense.
Bottom line is they never do, Robert.
Well, the truth is we need updated and new civil rights laws. We need updated and new police procedures. There's nowhere in police procedure that says to shoot somebody to stop them from fleeing. You have a radio.
Oh,
right.
Illegal.
You can put a car in front of them. You have helicopters.
And you can track them.
To shoot a fleeing
exactly.
felon.
you know, we've
on the Supreme Court case.
We've got a lot of issues, a lot of cases, a lot of things that have happened, and it seems to be a pattern when it comes to yep. of justice and how the outcome is. So that shouldn't have been a surprise.
Yeah, not well, and it's not. All right, we appreciate it. Thanks a bunch, Scott. Next time, be ready to ask questions to the about Thurgood Marshall. Up next, what the hell Thursday? That great. Describes Scott asking a question about Thurgood Marshall. That's next. News 1-9, TV 1.
So you want the truth. Well, we got it.
That's how I talk. God knows it. I'm just straight.
It's News 1 Now with Roland Martin.
All right, y'all. It's What the Hell Thursday. We've got some crazy stories, of course, with our media personalities. Joining me to my left in this,
why not jacket.
In these drapes. is Aruba timing. We got Lamont King. And also, next to Lamont, we have an empty chair for Britt Waters.
Good to see you.
Looking
good. Looking good.
She's a tan. She's looking mighty pale.
Yeah.
It might be.
I mean, I knew Britt was light skinned.
Some sun.
I knew Britt was light skinned, but what happened?
Yeah, she looking good over there.
Right. So I don't know why. So apparently Britt is stuck in traffic.
Is that what it is?
Because she didn't leave the house early enough.
Oh, man. I remember.
And she lived around the corner.
All
right, y'all, let's get right to it. We have all had bad customer service experience with cell phone carriers, but Metro PCS might have taken a cake because they ticked this brother off so bad, he took to the streets and went outside and fought their pop-up ad. Press play.
Okay. Oh, he fighting the squiggly man.
I'm not lying. I saw this online, and there's video, there's audio to this. Yeah. I wish we had audio, because the dude who was commentating while the video was playing is utterly hilarious. My man, I thought the boy got to be high.
Yeah, that's all high.
Lamont, he's fighting a pop-up.
It's a stage right before that high. That's as far as I'll go. Right before that high. I'm not going that high.
Somebody in that cell phone store pissed him off.
You think?
They pissed him off.
If you looked on the first round, he was losing. He was losing.
Oh, yeah.
Hold on, play it back. Play the video back.
Oh, yeah.
Play the video back. I didn't see it.
He bobbing and weaving. He missing. Swing.
Then he fell down.
Yeah, that's a slip.
That's a slip.
Standing 8 count. Here we go.
I mean, he's still with it. He didn't tear down the partition.
CompuBox saying he ain't landing 40% of his punches. Here we go. Now it's getting real.
Oh, right. Now I got to get butt naked. I got to take my shirt off.
Connection.
And then he falls down again.
That's MMA. He went straight to MMA.
That boy got some bad feet. All right, y'all.
He cut his phone off and hit it over 10 cents.
Kids usually drive their parents up the wall, but this baby gymnast actually drives himself up a wall. This kid here not only high jumps on a stack of whatever that is, but can we play the video? Thank you very much. But then sticks a backflip and Spider-Man's up the wall. Watch this.
Okay. And how old is he? That's a little man. That's like one of them little people, man.
Yeah.
And he gonna wave.
He's at least 19 years old.
Hold up. Watch the backflip.
Look at the form.
And then, okay, wall time.
That's a little Simeon boy. His name's Simeon.
What in? No. Now watch the wave at the end. Watch this here. Here you go. Watch this.
Better sound.
How you like me now?
Contract.
How you like me now? What in the world? Tommy, they gotta be scared. The boy.
I got a job for him. Universal Soul Circus. Oh.
What kind of job is that? Was that a pamper? Is it? How old is he? They say it was three. He said 3 years old.
Yeah, like 3 years old. All right, y'all. A driver in Baltimore took road rage to a whole new level. 68-year-old Laverne Doran's car was hit with a water bottle, which he thought came from a passing school bus. So my man decided to confront the bus driver and the students. No video. Okay, like, we don't have a video or it's not playing?
So what you think about that? That's
for real? Okay.
Let's see what she got to say.
Since
that's what I'm saying.
Wait a minute. So we don't have a video, so let me recreate the video.
Okay.
So I don't even know what the hell
What does it look like?
Just,
it out.
Just go on the break.
Sounds like.
Be back.
Your centerpiece for black thoughts in America.
I don't bend, I don't break.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
Well, it looks like we got that video I was talking about from Baltimore. Hit play. Oh. Dang.
Stop.
Matter of fact, I would have sped the hell up.
That's right.
Sure, what happened when you trample over the bus driver? His ass was on ornament.
Was
I mean, I'm sorry.
What was his issue?
He thought they threw a water bottle at his car. So he's had to hop on the front of the bus.
He's going to get up and duke it out.
I would have sped up and hit the brakes.
Oh. I might have would have.
Oh, yeah.
Say what I'd have did. Jump the curb one time. Give him a little, sit down. Jump the curb. One
that's what I would have done. All right, y'all. Let's go down.
Ran into a tree.
That's right. I would have stamped some bark on his butt. All right, today our HBCU Giving Day School is St. Philip's College in San Antonio, Texas. Their mission is to foster academic excellence and technical achievement among students. I'm going to be in San Antonio in Friday after next. So go to alamo.edu to make your donation. alamo.edu/foundation to make your donation. All right, y'all, birthday shout-out time. Actor Marcus Paulk turns 31. Mm. Former NBA player and all-track star Marion Jones turns 42 years old. On this day in history, in 1972, 46 black and white sailors were injured in a race riot on the aircraft carrier Kitty Hawk in North Vietnam. Y'all, I'm on assignment tomorrow in Los Angeles interviewing Smokey Robinson, and so we're still going to have a show. I'll be in L.A., so I'll see you guys on Monday. Be sure to tune in. Well, you know how we do. We keep it real. We keep it black right here on News One Now. We got to go. 50 Can in Memphis. I'll see y'all tonight. My keynote speech. Y'all take care. Holla!
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.